Oh, good evening, everybody. I think our 5-minute break is up. It's a pleasure to see everyone. Tonight's topic is the science and strength of self-compassion based on work by Dr. Kristen Neff, as well as Sharon Salzberg and the Buddha. So, join me thinking back to a time you made either a frustrating mistake at work or in your personal life. What did your inner voice say to you? For most of us, that inner voice is a very harsh critic, saying things we would never dream of saying to a friend. Our society is obsessed with self-esteem. You go into any bookstore, you're going to see a lot of books on self-esteem, especially in the self-help area. We are told that we must constantly feel special, be above average, and successful to feel good about ourselves. But what happens when we fail? Our self-esteem crashes and our inner critic takes over. Example: I am well past high school, okay? But I have a vivid memory of high school. This is back in the day of paper report cards. Okay, I went to high school in Tennessee, and teachers wrote the grades on it. And the school year is over. It's 10th grade for me. Got my driver's license. It was a good year. 10th grade is over. I've got my final report card for the whole year, and it is straight A's all the way across every subject. Slight overachiever. And my mother looks at it, points at one grade, and said, "What happened here?" And I looked, and it was an A minus. I am well past 17 years old, and I still remember this. I still remember this. It doesn't cause quite the angst in me it used to, or it did at that age. But that comment got my inner critic going, because I must not have been that great of an overachiever. So let's think of another example. To understand how this plays out in real life, imagine this everyday example. You're leading a major project at work. You stay up late, you rush through the details, and you accidentally send a flawed, inaccurate report to a critical client. The mistake is public, and it hurts. Now imagine manager A comes into your office. They slam the door and look at you with contempt and say, "What is wrong with you? Are you stupid? You always screw up the big moments. You're lucky you aren't fired." How would you feel? You would likely freeze up, feel sick to your stomach, and lose all motivation to fix the problem. Unfortunately, manager A is that voice in our head that most of us carry around with us every single day? That's that inner critic. But let's imagine manager B comes in. They sit down. They take a breath and say, "Hey, look, I know you're exhausted. You've been working 60-hour weeks. Everyone, including me, makes a bad call when they are running on empty. It's a tough situation. But let's take a breath, figure out how to patch this up with the client, and get you some rest." How do you feel now? Supported? Clear-headed? Ready to fix the mistake? Yeah. Manager B is the living embodiment of self-compassion. Dr. Kristen Neff has done significant research proving that we perform better under manager B. But to cultivate that voice, we must clearly define what we're talking about. So let's start with what is compassion? The word compassion literally means to suffer with. It's a two-step process. First, you must actually notice that someone else is suffering. You aren't too distracted to see it. Second, you feel moved by their pain, which warms your heart and triggers an active desire to help them alleviate that suffering. We've all felt compassion for other people. I'm sure if you take a moment and think, you can think of one recently, whether it was the checkout clerk at Publix or whatever your grocery store is, having a bad day, somebody you know and love, a stranger with a flat tire, something. We've all felt that compassion to help them alleviate the suffering they're in. So that's compassion. Self-compassion is simply taking that exact same process, but turning it inward. It's the practice of welcoming your own failures, your exhaustion, and imperfection with kindness rather than harsh judgment. Self-esteem asks, am I good enough? Self-compassion asks, what do I need right now to support myself? It's a big difference. Sharon Salzberg beautifully encapsulated this internal shift by reminding us, you yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. I'm going to say that again. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. Self-compassion means we fire manager A and we train ourselves to speak with the wisdom and warmth of manager B. While Dr. Kristen Neff's work is grounded in modern clinical psychology, her three-pillared framework didn't come from a vacuum. It's a direct translation of the Dharma, the timeless teachings on the nature of reality and the human mind. In Western psychology, we often separate compassion into two categories, for others and for myself. But in the Dharma, there's no such division. Compassion or karuna is an unconditional statement for all beings, and that includes you and me. In fact, in the traditional loving kindness meditation or metta, it demands that we offer compassion to ourselves first because we cannot pour from an empty well. I'm Southern, my parents are from North Carolina, and I grew up with the saying, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Which in today's world means we take care of ourselves because we can't be there for other people if we don't. So let's see how Dr. Neff's three pillars fit within this bridge to the Dharma. She talks about mindfulness versus over-identification, and this maps directly to the First Noble Truth, where we acknowledge the reality of dukkha or suffering, excuse me, and mindfulness allows us to witness our pain clearly without exaggerating it or running from it. The Buddha taught the famous parable of the two arrows. The first arrow is the unavoidable pain of life, the bad report, the traffic, illnesses, and the second arrow is our reaction to that pain, our self-blame, our fury. Mindfulness steps in to catch that second arrow before it strikes us. Another bridge is common humanity versus isolation. This reflects the Dharma teaching of anatta or non-self. When we step away from our ego, we realize that our flaws are not uniquely ours. They're simply universal conditions of a human mind navigating a very messy world. We're not alone. Others have the same stuff. Going back to Sharon Salzberg for a minute, she reflects on how the Buddha framed this universal truth by saying, "Here was the Buddha saying right out loud, there's suffering in life." It sounds depressing in popular misunderstandings, but it was very freeing to say, let's acknowledge this. Let's try to relate to this. We're not alone in isolation, but as a community of beings who all face this. There's suffering. We're not alone. Face it as a community of beings who all go through this suffering. And the third bridge to this framework is self-kindness versus self-judgment. This is the heart of sila, or ethical non-harming. Why do we assume mental violence against ourselves is acceptable? Self-criticism is mental violence. In the text, Theodana, it reminds us that searching all directions with your awareness, you find no one dearer than yourself. The Dharma tells us that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Pain is the first arrow. Suffering is the mental agony we choose to inflict on ourselves through Manager A's harsh voice. That critical voice. A massive roadblock people encounter is the belief that self-compassion is weak, passive, or self-indulgent. But the Dharma and Dr. Neff's work both agree true compassion requires fierce strength. Dr. Neff has two books. One is Self-Compassion, and the other one is Fierce Self-Compassion. In Buddhist psychology, compassion is one of the Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes, and it is never passive. It is an active force. Dr. Neff goes on to outline two essential signs of compassion, which mirror the balanced energies of the universe. The first is tender self-compassion. This is about being with ourselves. It focuses on acceptance, comforting, and soothing emotional pain. It's the reassurance that we are worthy just as we are. The second is fierce self-compassion, and this is about taking action. It's rooted in what the Dharma calls right effort. It involves protecting ourselves, drawing firm boundaries, saying no, and motivating ourselves to make necessary changes. Salzberg goes on and talks about compassion is not at all weak. It's the strength that arises out of seeing the true nature of suffering in the world. Compassion allows us to bear witness to that suffering, whether it is in ourselves or in others, without fear. It allows us to name injustice without hesitation and to act strongly with all the skill at our disposal. So compassion's not weak. Self-indulgence uses short-term numbing, like overeating or avoiding responsibility to escape life. Fierce self-compassion does the opposite. It steps up like a protective mother bear to defend our long-term well-being. We need both the tender hand over the heart and the fierce boundary to live a balanced, resilient life. I don't know about y'all, but I had a hard time setting boundaries. I thought I had to be there for everybody, all the time. Maybe that comes with being a mom or Southern, where we're supposed to always be polite and be helpful and kind. When I started setting boundaries, I had to remind myself I wasn't being negative. I wasn't being selfish. I was demonstrating self-care. That took a while to say no to invitations, to say no when I was too tired. But learning to set those boundaries and be fierce about my self-compassion has helped me have a balanced, more resilient life. So let's transition from this talk about theory and the Dharma and do a very short practice. I invite you to try the simple tool developed by Dr. Neff called the self-compassion break. If you're comfortable, close your eyes. Take a slow, deep breath for me. Let it out slowly. And I want you to think of a situation in your life right now that is causing you mild to moderate stress. Bring it to mind. And notice where you feel tension or tightness in your physical body. Now repeat these three phrases silently to yourself. First one is, this is a moment of suffering. Suffering is a part of life. Now place your hand over your heart or whatever body part you feel most comfortable with. Feel the warmth and pressure of your touch and say to yourself, may I be kind to myself in this moment. As you breathe through this, remember these words from Sharon Salzberg on what happens when your mind wanders into self-criticism. As we hone the ability to let go of distraction, to begin again without rancor or judgment, we are deepening forgiveness and compassion for ourselves. Take one more deep breath. Slow release and open your eyes when you are ready. That first statement, this is a moment of suffering, acknowledges the first arrow. And if that phrase feels too heavy or too long, you can just say, this hurts. The second one, suffering is a part of life. It activates in us a common humanity. You're connecting to the shared experience of every living being. You are not alone. It's not just your life, it's a part of the global life. We're not by ourselves. So the three phrases, just to remind you, this is a moment of suffering. Suffering is a part of life. And may I be kind to myself in this moment. Sometimes I switch that up with, may I love myself in this moment. May I be gentle with myself in this moment. Whatever phrase works better for you. We all have our own language that works for us. It's okay to change things. People often resist self-compassion because they think it will make them complacent. They think it's woo-woo, mindfulness, generic stuff. But science and spiritual history tell us the opposite. When we aren't terrified of our inner critic's lash, we are actually more willing to take risks, to learn from our mistakes, and to try again. Self-compassion builds true psychological resilience. If we're not resilient, how can we be compassionate for others? How can we practice metta? What is our right effort? If we're so bogged down by our inner critic, how can we have right effort? Think back one last time to the two managers at the beginning of our time together today. We cannot always control manager A, the inner critic. It wakes up and starts shouting in our heads at times. That inner critic is deeply ingrained. It's a habit. We're used to it fussing at us. But remember, you don't have to take their directives anymore. You do not have to believe what it says. The next time you fail or make a mistake or simply feel exhausted, take a breath and pause. Fire manager A on the spot, fire the inner critic. Take a deep breath and drop the second arrow and invite manager B into the room, the gentle, compassionate, understanding part of you. Give yourself the exact same grace, the patience, and the fierce protection you would give to anybody you love. And I know that's hard. We're so ingrained in our habits. We're so ingrained in hearing that voice. Many of us were raised with people telling us we weren't good enough, or had people at schools that said we weren't good enough. And sometimes those voices come back. But we are. We're kind, and we're loving and compassionate. If you weren't, you wouldn't be sitting. You wouldn't be here. You care about others. You care about the world around you. I'm asking you to focus on caring for yourself first so that you have the energy and the stamina to give to others. So before we move to Q&A stuff, I want to leave you with three things to try over the next week to turn this theory into a daily habit. The first one I call catch and reframe. Try once a day to catch yourself saying something harsh to yourself. And stop yourself as soon as you recognize it and ask yourself, would I say this to a friend I love? If not, rewrite the script. Right then. I'm a perfectionist. I say something harsh to myself all the time, especially when I'm trying to cook something new. I don't like failing. And if it doesn't come out right, I'm like, ah, why did I even try? I can't do this. So I catch myself, usually when I say, why did I even try? And I stop and I remind myself, I rewrite that script and go, I tried to learn how to cook this. I can't be perfect at it when I've never done it before. I haven't put in enough practice to be really good at this yet. So rewrite your script as soon as you catch yourself. That's catch and reframe. The second tip is a 20-second soothing touch. When you feel a spike of stress this week, Dr. Neff suggests trying a physical anchor. You can place a hand over your heart. You can cross your arms in a gentle hug. You can cradle your face. Hold it for 20 seconds. It instantly triggers your body's calming parasympathetic response. Sometimes I will rub the spot in my fingers right here. It's a pressure point. And I'll rub that 20 seconds. Find the spot on you that works best for you. It will be different for everybody. The third is to normalize the mess. When something goes wrong, say out loud, "This is a messy moment." Messy moments are part of being human. Break the illusion that's in your mind that everyone else has it completely figured out. They don't. I don't. You don't. We don't have it figured out. Many times I lived by the saying, fake it till you make it, because I had no idea what I was doing. But I just went with it. Example, I got hired to teach marketing for an undergraduate program out of college that focused on the business side of the fashion industry. I am not a fashion person. I don't know. At that point, I knew nothing about the fashion industry. And that was the entire focus of this college. Fashion marketing, fashion merchandising, visual design. Everything fashion related, but the business side, not creating clothing or accessories. I faked it till I made it. I subscribed to Women's Wear Daily. I did what I had to do to educate myself very quickly. I read everything I could find. And I got to a point where at commencement, I could sit on the stage with other faculty and see the students walk by, and I could tell you what shoes they were wearing. Because that's a big thing in New York City. College seniors in that program would get their first pair of Louboutins when it was on sale, or the first pair of Jimmy Choos, or their first pair of whatever. And the faculty would be up there going, "That's this, that's this, that's this." It was a game we played. But I did not know what I was doing when I walked in the door. Could I teach marketing? Yes. Related to fashion? Not so much. And I had to realize that everybody starts somewhere. And I had to be gentle with myself. I'm asking you to normalize the mess. We covered a lot today, from modern psychology of Dr. Neff to how it ties into the wisdom of the Dharma and the everyday reality of having to fire that harsh inner critic. And we may have to fire him several times because they'll come back. Changing the way we talk to ourselves is deeply personal, and it's an ongoing journey, as evidenced by my example about the report card. I still remember it. Because of that, I want you to make sure that today, with total clarity, you understand how to apply these ideas to your life. So, whether you have a question about balancing fierce and tender boundaries, or how this connects to mindfulness, or just a practical roadblock you foresee in your upcoming week, the floor is yours. And I want to say thank you for your practice and follow that with what questions might you have for me today? While
John,
you're all warming
no,
up,
John here in the room.
okay, go
John,
ahead.
I just was I had come to a positive place where, and it was recent because I've been meditating a long time to stop being so harsh with myself, and it was pleasant. So it was really nice to hear you affirm that tonight. So that, it was a nice lecture. So
Thank
thank you.
you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I do want to make a comment as well.
Go ahead.
I appreciate your words. I think one thing you said specifically was that people often resist self-compassion because they believe it'll make them complacent. And I related to that because I think that that's what I fear, that if I let go of my inner critic, then who is the one to quote unquote keep me in line? Can you share your thoughts on that and how to, I guess, strike that balance?
Sure. So the inner critic for a lot of folks acts like an abusive coach, if you will. It
Okay.
gets short-term results at a really harsh, almost, well, it is painful for a lot of people, really harsh and painful commentary, but it eventually causes burnout, depression, and risk aversion. It
Yeah.
shuts us down. So while we think it's going to keep us in line, for the short term it may, but ongoing, it has the opposite effect.
Yeah.
It almost is like fear-based motivation, and it will fail over time.
Yeah.
The other side of that is what's called the good parent framework. So think about a parent who punishes a child for a failing grade. A self-compassionate parent hugs the child first and then says, "I love you, but we need to figure out a better homework routine."
Yeah.
That's the fierce part of the compassion, saying there's an action we need to take. It's not complacent. It's, "I love you. Now we got to figure something out."
Yeah.
So the kindness provides the emotional safety, making it safe for us to look at our flaws honestly, without the fear of an inner beating, if you will, the
Yeah.
inner harshness of those words, because words are as painful as a physical slap. They're not any less harmful.
Yeah.
So I think when you're looking at being self-compassionate, the complacency only happens if you don't put the fierce part in, if you don't put action in place.
Yeah.
You can be loving and gentle with yourself and have a plan and act on that plan.
Yeah.
Does that help?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
The understanding of starting with the kindness and still opening the floor up for where there could be room for improvement.
Yeah, I mean it's we're honest with ourselves, right?
Yeah.
We're, part of insight meditation is not only the mindfulness part, but it's the insight part where we look at ourselves honestly
Yeah.
and find out what our areas of needed improvement may be.
Yeah.
Where are we judging others? Where are we desiring things and hanging on to stuff,
Yeah.
So we're still able to do that without somebody yelling at us in our head, hearing old tapes.
Yeah.
Instead, go, "Yeah, that's old news. I don't need that. I recognize I'm not perfect and I have flaws and I've got some stuff in place to work on." Can you work on all of it at once? No. So you pick and choose, and you make progress.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for the question.
Comment on
Yeah, Satish wants to make a comment.
Sure. Hey, Satish.
I think when somebody is compassionate with us, we are so moved and motivated to whatever they are saying, make it happen right again. it's more of a motivation. Whereas if somebody is being judgmental, it's a negative effect on us, and we get into the avoidance mode. And compassion part has to be done very right, because it can be a backhanded compassion.
What do you mean by backhanded compassion?
For example, you did it right, but we have to make this change, you know?
So it's got a but in there. It's got a,
Yeah,
you did it
right.
right, but it could be better.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. And you bring up a good point. There's compassion or self-compassion when we add those little extra negative things on the end, that inner critic is still back there. And it's going to take a while to shut up the inner critic. It's not going to happen the first time you do this. It takes practice, because that voice has been in with us for a really long time. Some of us for decades, right? I am in my 60s at this point, so it's been there. And I know it well. So getting it quiet down, it may add that little but at the end, at the beginning of your practice on this, but the more you set the boundaries of, no, this was good, then you set what your motivation is going to be, the fierce part. What's my plan? Let's figure this out.
Can I share my experience?
Yeah, please.
I go to the gym, doing that good bit of my life, and I've got some residual muscle aches. There's no injury or anything like that. It's just my back of my legs and the front of my legs are aching. And so I've been sitting here meditating, listening to you talk about self-compassion and really appreciating your wisdom in that regard. I'm also experiencing this sense of being able to open to more and more in-depth accepting awareness of that urgent unpleasantness, the muscles, and just kind of working with that. And, it might be considered to be lacking compassion. Why don't I just, change my posture or something like that? But the issue is not so much about the pain, which is familiar. It's not alarming. It's uncomfortable, but I can soak into it. There's an awareness of how the mind creates that relationship with the discomfort that has a quality of compassion in terms of learning how to not be so reactive. So it's a different understanding for me. What came together with this is an understanding of compassion that it's not so much about. I mean, I'm certainly capable of self-loathing. I've talked about that many times, but that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about when I'm not being in that self-critical place, I can really kind of have compassion that is useful for in the process of liberating the mind, not so much being less controlled by impulsive reactivity, but being able to be more open. It's just I just wanted to think out loud about it, because that was a different understanding of compassion, self-compassion.
Yeah. No, and I appreciate that. It reminds me, when I first decided to do this topic, and I'd been thinking about it for a while, I had to ask myself why this? Because if you look at the Dharma, there's no mention of self-compassion. There's compassion, but there's no mention of self-compassion. And I'd read Dr. Neff's work found it interesting. And with my other readings having to deal with pain management, and as I've mentioned in here before, I have rheumatoid arthritis and some other autoimmune stuff. So I live in pain. And as you just mentioned, Peter, some of it's just now my normal, right? It's not something for me to worry about. It's just there. Initially, to get to a point where being in pain every day was not debilitating, I had to look inward and go, what does this pain mean? What does it mean, and where is it? Where is it exactly? And is it, noting it and labeling it helps, because then I can determine what's my normal and what's unusual. And I can get up in the morning and doing a body scan while I'm having a cup of coffee, and I can, with self-compassion, go, this is the kind of day it's going to be today. I'm not going to be able to get these three things done I thought I was going to do because I don't have that kind of energy because such and such hurts and I don't want to strain it more than it is. Or I could have a morning where I'm like, ooh, I feel this in my legs and my thighs and my calves and my forearms because we were in the garden yesterday. And man, it feels great to have those aches because that meant I could do it. And although it hurts, and it means today's going to be a rest day for me, I'm gentle and kind with myself, recognizing what I did yesterday, which I hadn't been able to do in a while. And today means I rest. And that's okay. That's the boundary I set up, the fierce boundary of I'm not going to overdo it so that I'm not out of bed. But I'm going to rest today and I'm going to be compassionate, paying attention to my body. So, thank you for bringing up your example of the gym and such, because it reminded me how I even got into this particular topic. Linda, you got your hand up. Jump in.
You had mentioned that there was no statement about self-compassion, in the teachings, but I'm thinking of the sutta, which is also a chant. I will abide with a heart imbued with compassion to the first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter, and to all as to myself. So, to myself, to me, that means self-compassion. So it may not be a big deal, but it is there.
It is there in the respect that it's for everyone, including me.
Including yourself,
Yes. It is there for that respect. There's not the specific phrase of self-compassion, but you're correct. It is in the Dharma. There's a few places where it talks about for all living beings. Well, that means you too, right? That means us too. So it is there, but not how we've separated it in today's combination of mindfulness and psychology and Buddhism and such. But thank you for bringing that up. That's a beautiful sutta.
Yeah, it is.
Satish, you have something?
Yeah, so Peter, you were talking about the pain you had. Then, did I hear you? Did you mean that you don't want to change the posture? So, because then you won't be compassionate with yourself?
Well, if I knew that the pain was because of an injury, it would be compassionate to move my leg. But I know that the pain is familiar. I know that there's no injury there. So I'm accepting it as a point of practice to learn how to cultivate equanimity.
Okay, what if today, whatever the reason for your pain is, if move, changing your posture would help it? Would that be okay for you?
Is the idea is to understand how the mind creates a self, creates life, creates living in the world. And so that may at one point involve wise moving of the body because the circumstances are provide the opportunity for opening, and that opening is compassion. It's the ultimate goal of compassion is total opening. Or the conditions might be right in the mind and the body to sit with it and notice what goes on. And as we're talking, I'm also noticing, and this goes to the issue of impermanence, that there's a period of time when I'm very strongly and kind of absorptively aware of that discomfort. And it seems so durable and so outstanding. I have to pay attention to this. And then I'm listening to what Satish is saying, and I realize, wow, where's that intensity? It's gone. Where's the mind that was so reactive, that was trying to settle in and accept? It's different now. And that I find part of that's an important part of my practice, is realizing how my mind gets preoccupied, and then just be able to just let it go.
So you're staying with the first arrow, and you're not letting the second arrow come to you.
Well, the second arrow has a subtler aspect to it. It requires more and more sensitive internal awareness. It's not so much about fighting as it is about a deeper and deeper willingness to let go.
That's the first arrow. Still, I think you're staying with it. I think. But anyway, John has a question.
It was just a comment that I think at a certain age you learn the thinking distinction from the feeling distinction, and you start feeling feelings instead of thinking the feeling, which, you do a lot of damage with words. You don't realize it's your mind. You can hurt yourself, and then you stop, and suddenly things are smoother for me. And I think everybody comes to some point where they distinguish that and are able to lighten up.
Yeah.
I hope.
Before we get too far into what time we have left, I want to bring up something. There is something that happens when one starts practicing this, and that is when self-compassion can hurt. So if you think about it, Dr. Neff calls this backdraft. When a firefighter opens the door and oxygen rushes in, it causes the fire to flare intensely. So when we finally offer ourselves love and compassion, it exposes to us all the ways we haven't been loved or accepted in the past. And the pain is being released by compassion. It's not being caused by it. But it's not a fun part, right? We're recognizing when we've had gaps in compassion by people we love. So if the emotional heat of doing this practice becomes too intense, when you're meditating, open your eyes, drop the meditation. One of the things I do is I identify three different colors in my room. Other people will stamp their feet to feel grounded in the external reality versus in that meditation moment. And that helps get you back into the present moment so you can breathe and then contemplate what you just discovered. Does that make sense? Yep, Peter says, yes, it makes sense. Cool. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. There are different kinds of boundaries. There's external boundaries and internal boundaries. And, the external boundaries basically negotiating your needs with another being. But the internal boundaries is what you were, I think, were just alluding to, the expectations that we're conditioned to have.
I'm curious to know maybe some possible other examples you may have when it comes to the fierce self-compassion, like the side of it that is like the you said like the protective mama bear. What are some examples through life when it comes to family, friends, people that are close to you that you could share?
Well, remember, we're talking about self-compassion, right?
Right.
So, for example, when you do a metta practice or a loving kindness practice, one of the first things they think is what they say is to say those statements of metta about yourself first. And a lot of people have a hard time with that in Western society. So sometimes teachers will move the self part to the end and start with someone you may see at the grocery store that you don't know well, somebody you love, somebody you have dislike for or struggles with, and then yourself.
Yeah.
Because we have a hard time in our society of feeling comfortable being compassionate and loving to ourselves because it feels selfish. We've been told it's selfish to think of ourselves first,
Yeah.
right? So reframe that, reword it, redescribe it to be self-care, not selfish.
Yeah.
You are caring for yourself by setting boundaries. I had to learn to set boundaries. I used to work in New York City and fly home to Orlando. Long story how that happened, but I commuted. And I would come home for long weekends, like come home on a Thursday night and go back up to New York on a Tuesday. And every minute of my time back in Orlando was booked. And I felt like I went back to New York to get rest. And I was going back to New York for work. Because it was nonstop. I felt like I didn't get a chance to just be, to be at my home, to be with my family. I felt like it was constant movement. And the first time I said to my other half, please tell people no. I realized they haven't seen me, I've been gone, because I would come home like 5 days a month. And I'd realize I've been gone for three and a half weeks. But the balance I needed, the boundaries I needed to refuel, replenish, to have compassion, to give to others, required me to have some time where it wasn't constantly going. And I had to say no, and I had to not see people all the time. And they were friends. And I'm like, I just can't. I'll see you next time I'm home. And I had to start spacing things out. And it was really difficult the first time, explaining to my partner that I can't do this. I need to come home and relax.
So
I need to come home.
how did you manage that subjectively, procedurally? You notice what's going on when, a friend calls and part of you misses the going there, wants to do it, another part of us can't. How do you work through that procedurally
It, you
or
know, Peter, it was sometimes it would be I'd be home and we'd get a call and it's like, oh, let's do dinner, let's go to this, the show's in town, come on over, let's do this, can we come over? And I'm like, I just got off a plane with screaming children on their way to Disney.
Right.
And
So
I just,
that's the one part of the situation. But what
right.
was the story and what was the feeling in the body?
The feeling in the body was one of dread and tightness going, how do I bring this up?
Yeah.
How do I bring this up to my other half going, I need you to be my gate because I'm not here. I'm in New York City. So when people call and say, hey, when's Susan coming back home? Let's get together. I need you to say no. We can do one thing when I get home. But other than that, I need some downtime with just you and the kids. I need some time at my house. I need to breathe. And it was really hard, and my stomach was tight and tense. I carry a lot of stress in my shoulders. It felt like my shoulders were up to my ears. And it was just this feeling of how is this going to come across?
So how did you let that go procedurally? How did your practice, your meditation practice?
I sat a lot going, it's okay to ask for what I need. It's okay to set boundaries.
And did your shoulders go along with that?
My shoulders went along with it. It took a little bit of time. My shoulders went along with it. This is before I got diagnosed with any autoimmune stuff. But that also reinforced, when I got those diagnoses, it reinforced the need for me to slow down, that I needed to have rest time built in, or a rejuvenation time, if you will. You know, being with just a few people at a time and not seeing everybody at once. You know, so that sort of forced the issue. But before that, it was okay, I'm not hurting my other half's feelings. They understand. And if my friends don't, they can talk to me. And I'm like, look, I work 14-hour days in New York because I'm the only one up there. My family's not there. I'm not off gallivanting around and touring and doing whatever. I'm working because that's my job up there, is to work, and I come home to relax and have downtime. So when I come home, I don't want to entertain. I'm entertaining students in a classroom in New York. You know, so it was a lot of walking meditation, trying to feel grounded, a lot of trying to feel grounded.
Yeah, I find that for me, when I get hooked like that, about boundaries, internal boundaries and interpersonal boundaries, to go to where the tension is in my body and let it go, because they tend to feed off each other. Story seems to justify the energy in the body. The energy in the body validates the story, and it just builds.
It just cycles then.
Right. So I have to practice letting go with the breath. Just keep letting go and letting go when I feel that pressure.
And I found for me, when the pressure at the very beginning, I'd have to do walking meditation. Sitting wasn't helping. I'd have to have movement with it to help my body relax. It's hard to walk with your shoulders up here. You know, it's hard to walk when your stomach's really tight. So after a little bit, half a block to a block, things start loosening up and you can breathe deeper. And you can concentrate more on things flowing through. And I could go, I'm not going to worry about that today. Let it go. And the body would relax. And I would do readings on setting boundaries and self-compassion and self-care. And that's how I worked through it. But it took a while.
Oh yeah, more practice is necessary.
Always, because it's practice,
Yeah,
right?
I'm not being facetious when I say that this is the work of a lifetime.
Oh, yeah, it
And my
is.
lifetime is dedicated to kind of trying to integrate being mindful and compassionate into my
Yes.
lifestyle.
It is. And I am taking this time in my life. My children are adults at this point, and I repeatedly tell them, learn from me now. Do not wait until you're older to get this stuff. It's okay to set boundaries. It's okay. And they both meditate and they both do yoga. I'm like, you know, you need to be grounded. You need to be centered. You need to be taking care of yourself first, because you can't give something to your partner or your children if you're empty. So that's what I do. And I hope that that answered your question, Florian.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Very much so. Thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
I think second, setting boundaries can be compassionate with the spirit you're setting those boundaries.
Compassionate for yourself and for the other person.
Yes, exactly.
If you see that they're pushing themselves too hard.
Or this boundary, so both are considered, you know, that they have to consider be considerate about you too, you know. So I see no problem with that.
So, Florin, you have the last word, and then we're going to close the meeting for this evening.
I didn't know. I was just responding with yeah in agreement to.
Thank
So
you.
I've completed my question, but thank you.
Awesome.
So this meeting goes till 9 or what time? Or
Yes. Up to 9.
no.
So we still got 10 minutes, right?
It's an hour meeting. We start at 9. We start at
7.
7:50. The
Yep.
Dharma talk.
Okay, I see.
So, next week is one of the things we've started doing this last year or so. I'm going to be available to discuss with you your meditation practice or the Buddhist concepts about the practice. So I look forward to that. I very much enjoy that kind of discussion. So, as is our custom, let's sit together briefly. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well, and I hope that we're reasonably safe and happy till we have a chance to talk again.